It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you have trouble with the much more specific belief that Jesus is the Son of God. And even more, you don't like hearing that Jesus is the only path of salvation. Well, if this is your concern, you have come to the right place. We began a discussion about the reasons Jesus claims to be exclusive as a remedy. We began that discussion a couple of weeks ago, and we should have time to conclude it today after the latest news. And boy, there's a lot of news. At first, the Obama administration accused the new Arizona law of violating civil rights. Our president offered a powerful, emotionally stirring lament about how an Hispanic family will not even be able to go out for ice cream without being harassed by the police. It just brought a tear to my eye when I heard this. Then, Attorney General Eric Holder admitted before the Senate that he had not actually read the bill. Hadn't even read the cotton-picking thing. This revealed an explanation not only for his own ignorant comments, but in all probability, an explanation for the famous Obama ice cream speech. In fact, the bill goes out of its way to forbid racial profiling. It only allows the police to ask questions of people who were already stopped for legitimate concerns, such as a traffic violation. And so, interestingly enough, by the time our Justice Department, at Obama's instigation, decided to sue Arizona, they were forced to alter their concern. In debating, they call that altering the premise of the argument midstream. Now, supposedly, the only problem is that of a state interfering with what was intended to be federal law. Yeah, I believe that. I buy that as their true concern, because now civil rights are not even mentioned in the suit. You see, there are several problems with DOJ's historical revision. First, this obviously is not the real concern, because little was said initially about federal versus state stuff. Obama and his followers limited most of their huffing and their puffing to civil rights. Second, there is nothing in our Constitution which says a state cannot enforce a federal law. I can't guarantee you that some nutcase judge won't pretend that it is, because judges seem to find things in the Constitution that aren't really there these days. But if you actually read the Constitution, it ain't in there, Jack. Three, the federal government has shown almost zero interest in protecting our borders. So obviously they are not worried about the state getting out of their way so they can do their job. And if they were, why have we seen no lawsuits against states with sanctuary cities? Aren't sanctuary cities violating federal law? Number four, the Arizona police were already within their jurisdiction to ask people if they were in the country legally. They've been doing it for years. I mean, for Pete's sakes. If they can enforce a teen curfew, they could certainly enforce a person's legal status. The new law did little more than add an unnecessary updated incentive with words more directly to the point. Translation, Obama's real concern is a policy of amnesty and open borders, possibly because he has gotten a myriad of criticism from the left for not moving farther in their direction, possibly because amnesty before this November would mean, supposedly, a grateful new Democratic voting bloc, or possibly because such a course of action sincerely fits smugly with his other Marxist global anti-American policies. Oh, well. Hey, am I the only one getting hungry for ice cream about now? Rocky Road is my favorite. Meanwhile, while the DOJ makes headlines by suing the state of Arizona for enforcing its borders, other DOJ news surfaces, namely their unwillingness to prosecute Black Panthers who stood in front of voting booths during the 2008 presidential election using harassment, using intimidation, you know, the kinds of tactics Democrats always accuse Republicans of doing without a shred of evidence ever, but they always accuse Republicans of doing it. And this time it was really done. This time it's been filmed. Hey, is it just me? Call me simple, but the unwillingness to prosecute thugs and instead prosecute police does not make our Justice Department look like they really care about justice. In any event, the situation just grew worse with the surfacing of a video. Now you can hear for yourself some racist vile coming from the mouth of one such Black Panther poll guard. He claimed to hate all white people, but he didn't stop there. He called for the death not only of white adults, but white babies as well. Oh, wait. Almost forgot. We're not allowed to call this racism. No. That's because over the years, our current civil rights movement has changed the definition of racism. They just made up a new one. And people are dumb enough to roll over and play dead for this new one. Whereas once racism meant hating a particular race, pretty obvious meaning of the word, the phrase is now reserved for white people alone. You got that? White people alone, because white people have all the power. Yeah, I and you, we have more political power supposedly than Jesse Jackson or Jeremiah Wright or Louis Farrakhan. And I have more money, obviously, than Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan, or Colin Powell. People of color can never be racist, and all white people without exception are racist. See how it works? So don't expect to witness too much concern from the left for this latest poison tirade. Instead, hear about how our country once held slaves and once had segregation laws. There will be zero appreciation for any progress over the years, and they will virtually ignore that little picnic our nation once had called the Civil War, where people died to end slavery. People, more than ever, it's time to return to the wisdom of the Bible, which dubbed all people sinners, regardless of race or nationality. No, we do not all share the same sin, but neither does sin have racial bounds. There are white racists. There are black racists. The very fact that I even need to take the time to say that shows how backwards our country has become. We have regressed in time before the 60s to a new era of bigotry, even worse than the first, because currently the very people who fought to overcome racism are now fighting to bring it back. They won't admit that just because they retitle the word racism with terms like restitution or terms like reparation. That doesn't mean they are any less guilty than the pointy-headed, sheet-clad men of old. Now, I realize that this story is much bigger than the hatred of the Black Panthers. There is also the issue of our mainstream media ignoring the story, and the absolutely harrowing matter of our Department of Justice refusing to prosecute the Black Panthers. I said a little bit about that, but wait till you hear their reasons, and I'm going to talk about that not today, because I'm giving my thoughts some time to crystallize. Then I promise to share them with you next week. I had reasons for not wanting to speak out on this too quickly. One of them is that I believe in activating my brain before activating my mouth. You know the old saying, better to be silent and be thought the fool than to speak and remove all doubt. But our Speaker of the House doesn't seem to know of this rule. Today, it is my unbridled pleasure to share Nancy Pelosi's latest wit and wisdom. I'm reading from Fox News, July 1st, 2010. Unemployment benefits are creating jobs faster than practically any other program, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Thursday. Talking to reporters, the House Speaker was defending a jobless benefits extension against those who say it gives recipients little incentive to work. By her reasoning, those checks are helping to give somebody a job. It injects demand into the economy, Pelosi said, arguing that when families have money to spend, it keeps the economy churning. It creates jobs faster than almost any other incentive you can name. Pelosi said the aid has the double benefit of helping those who lost their jobs and acting as a job creator on the side. It's impossible to think of a situation where we would have a country that would say we're not going to have unemployment benefits, Pelosi said. Yes, I'm sure she must be right. Exactly how paying people even more to be unemployed will booster our economy, I'm sure I don't know. But then I'm not an elected congresswoman who achieved the title Speaker of the House. That's what a speaker does. She speaks. And the more she talks, the more amazed I am. Others must be amazed, too. How else would we account for the woman's constant reelection? If only Nancy Pelosi could have been there through other critical times of history. I cannot resist using my imagination. Pelosi on the great San Francisco fire. If we lit some dynamite, we might just cause an explosion big enough to put the fire out. Pelosi at Gettysburg. The surest way to end slavery is to stop this horrible war. That will secure the economy of the South. Who knows? After those plantation owners get wealthy enough, they may just set their slaves free. Pelosi speaking at Munich. If we want Hitler to stop conquering countries, we should simply give in to all of his demands. History has shown that when an adventurous dictator is appeased, he always backs off. Well, we'll have more of Pelosi, dearest, through history when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. Nancy Pelosi says that another stimulus that gives money to unemployed people is going to boost our economy. So I've been going through history, trying to use my imagination and wonder what Nancy would say about other crises. I have two more to do. Pelosi speaking to Ben Franklin. I admire your desire to invent and discover things, but you really should come out of the rain and put that kite away. After all, your health comes first, especially with my health care plan. A long life leads to all kinds of inventive enterprises. And finally, Pelosi over Snow White's sleeping body. If we force feed her a second apple, who knows? It might just act as an antidote to the first one, and then maybe the dear lass will awaken. Oh, what? You say a prince is on his way? How old-fashioned and chauvinistic is that? Just do as I say and cram that apple down her pipes. On to other news. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden has been given instructions by President Obama to reach out to Muslim nations. What exactly does our space program have to do with the religion of Islam? A partial explanation was supplied. Obama wants Muslims to feel good about their historical contribution to science and their historical contribution to mathematics. Now, I got to confess, this one really throws me for a loop. I realize we have had Muslim scientists, but I'm unaware of what any Muslim country or organization has collectively added to the space program. Oh, wait. Of course. We fired rockets into space and Hamas fires rockets into Israel. I guess there's a bit of common ground after all. True, when we fire our rockets into space, we aren't aiming them at anybody, but I suppose that's just a minor detail. Speaking of Israel, great news, wonderful news, fantastic development in the never-ending struggle for world peace. It looks like Israel and the Obama administration have mended their damaged relationship. Oh, people, what a delight to pass this on. I bring you glad tidings of good cheer. Of course, Israel had to make a few minor concessions, real little things, hardly worth mentioning. She had to agree to lighten up on her blockade against terrorist supplies going into Gaza to Obama. This is a good start. Next, he will press Israel to unravel her blockade even more, and then naturally, Israel must finally grant that separate Palestinian state, which will include giving half of her capital city of Jerusalem to the Palestinians. You see, the Palestinians have proven themselves to be such good neighbors. I'm sure the two countries will live in harmony forever and ever. Hey, Israel, if you really want to please our current president, maybe you can promise to give up your entire country. Just allow the Arabs to take all your land and all your homes and all your lives. Then at long last, there will be peace. Real peace. True, you'll be dead, but at least you'll be spared another UN resolution. You'll also incur the favor and eternal gratitude of the wisest, most moral president ever to grace our fair planet. But in all fairness to Obama and the Democrats, I need to also raise the question, how wise is the Republican Party these days? Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, was the first of many conservatives to call for the resignation of GOP Chairman Michael Steele, who during a fundraiser in Newark, Connecticut, not only claimed that Obama should get out of Afghanistan, but that Afghanistan was Obama's war. I'm reading his exact words as quoted from Politics Daily. He says, "Keep in mind again, for our federal candidates, this was a war of Obama's choosing. This is not something the United States had actively prosecuted or wanted to engage in. It was the president who was trying to be cute by flipping a script demonizing Iraq while saying the battle really should be in Afghanistan. Well, if he's such a student of history, has he not understood that, you know, that's the one thing you don't do is engage in a land war in Afghanistan? All right, because everyone who has tried over 1,000 years of history has failed, and there are reasons for that. There are other ways to engage in Afghanistan." Those are the words of GOP Chairman Michael Steele. Now, let me say, all in all, I have liked and admired Michael Steele, but this time I must agree that his remarks are inexcusable. Are we now going to imitate the Democrats by politicizing a war? And will such politics come at the cost of indisputable facts? I mean, at the expense of making the most obvious understatement of the 21st century, George Bush brought us into Afghanistan, and rightly so. The mastermind of 9/11, Osama bin Laden, had been granted sanctuary in that country by the Taliban. Now, Steele would certainly be welcome to criticize Obama's horrible execution of the war, including ludicrous rules of engagement and schedules announcing ahead of time when we're going to withdraw. Obama's performance as commander-in-chief staggers the imagination, and Steele has plenty of legitimate ammunition. Be that as it may, Obama did not bring us into Afghanistan. And any insinuation to the contrary can only be ranked with those intelligent speeches that blame George Bush for starting hurricanes. Some have expressed concern that by calling for Steele's resignation, the Republicans may get painted as a racist party once again. Steele, after all, being African American, served as a welcomed reminder that our problem with Obama is his policy and not his skin color. Will conservatives be accused for the umpteenth time of being unable to handle a black man in power? Of course they will. Did you even need to ask? The left shows no indication that they tire of playing this wild card. Indeed, given the kinds of outlandish statements coming out of Steele's mouth recently, we can't be all too sure that the man won't cry racism himself. I'm not saying he will, and I certainly hope he doesn't, but perhaps we should brace ourselves for any possibility. In my opinion, giving into the fear of being called racist would be a disaster for Republicans and other conservatives. For one thing, it throws out our very first argument, namely that Steele has disgraced his party by using the devices of Democrats. Whether the tactic is politicizing a war or whether the tactic is injecting race into an argument, the hypocrisy would be the same. We can't rebuke Steele for being disingenuous all the while keeping him on due to our own political correctness. Besides, the left will sling those racist accusations like mud balls no matter what Republicans do, right? Supporting Clarence Thomas didn't matter. Supporting Condoleezza Rice didn't matter. Supporting Colin Powell made no difference. The very history of Republicans, created as a party against slavery, makes no difference. The fact that untold numbers of Democratic politicians have a legacy of supporting Jim Crow laws, and the prestigious Senator Bob Byrd, who recently passed away, also had been a member of the KKK, that makes no difference. So why would the left explore our legitimate reasons for encouraging Steele to resign? The left will hate us and lie about us no matter what we do. We may as well do what is right. By placing ethics above public opinion, we can regain the respect of fellow conservatives who are tired of the pandering and compromising. The others are not going to join our cause anyway. Why do we lose so much sleep over their goodwill? We have one window of opportunity to bake back our country this November. We must vote the Democrats out of office. That's how we take back the country. We must reclaim the House. We must reclaim the Senate. If we miss this chance, we will find ourselves on a road without any turns. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Right before we went to the break, I said we have one window of opportunity to take back our country this November. I said we have to vote the Democrats out of office, reclaim the House and the Senate. I said if we miss this chance, we will find ourselves on a road without any turns. I'm glad we had a break because it gave me a chance to say it again because it can't be said too many times. Now, listen to me carefully, fellow conservatives and Republicans. Even if the Republican in your district is a rhino, Republicans in name only, and rhinos infuriate me too, the sheer number of elected Republicans, you got to look at the grand strategy here, the sheer number of elected Republicans, some good, some not so good, will nevertheless put them in the majority, and who knows, perhaps, just perhaps, fewer will compromise this time. I know it's a thin thread of a chance, but we have to take it. It can, of course, be argued that Obama and the Democrats have already done irreparable damage in the year and a half they've been in office, and there is certainly no guarantee that Republicans, once in power again, will honor the people who put them there instead of worrying every morning about what the New York Times has to say. I'm not so naive as to promise that reclaiming Congress will save the country. I'm not saying it'll work. All I'm saying is we better try it. After Republicans take back the House and the Senate, which I'm convinced they will, be careful not to breathe too big a sigh of relief. Remember, we will still have two more years of Obama, and he will be as slippery as ever. He got elected by running against George Bush, even though Bush wasn't running. He continues to excuse his own bumbling, incompetent mistakes by blaming Bush, who's been out of office for 2.5 years, and by blaming some of the Republicans who, although in office, hold no majority and no voting strength. Zero, zip, no voting strength. If Republicans take back Congress, Obama will still have a virtual free hand to continue destroying our foreign policy. Oh, true. On the domestic front, the absence of Democrats will slash the funds he needs for his tax and spend fixings of our economy. But that will be the exact excuse he needs. The bully pulpit will blast away, explaining how those nasty Republicans are keeping our president from rescuing America. On the other hand, if the economy rebounds, as it just may when fiscally responsible people are in the House and Senate once again, then Obama will grab all the credit. It's a win-win situation for the guy, and we must not allow him to get away with his lying, poisonous interpretations, which leads to my greatest concern. There is an issue more important than the economy, more important than health care, and more important than anything you can think of, protecting our rights to free speech being threatened from talks of internet takeover and fairness doctrines. If we lose our right to speak, none of the other stuff will matter anymore. Only in the true platform of ideas can the hypocrisy of a president who blames others for his mistakes and takes bows for accomplishments he had nothing to do with be exposed for the house of cards it really is. Now, you might be wondering, because we had a fairness doctrine once before. A lot of people don't realize that. And what did radio hosts talk about before Ronald Reagan lifted the fairness doctrine? Well, the little petty everyday annoyances of life. And I like talking about them. I do talk about them. I don't think they're that important. But here, I'll show you. Here's what it's going to be like if we ever get the fairness doctrine. I'm going to instead spend most of my time talking about fast food restaurants. And believe me, I could do that. I could do that till the cows come home, because I have seldom had great experiences at fast food restaurants. I like the food. Don't care much for the service. Now, I know I shouldn't generalize. I shouldn't generalize, especially when the problem may be that a little black cloud follows me around. But far too often, the workers at our hamburger stands and the workers at our hot dog stands and the workers at our burrito counters have not been the sharpest pencils in the box. This is made abundantly clear by the long conversations preceding my eventual experience of actually eating the food. Is this for here or to go? For here. Your name? Bob. Thanks. Is it for here or to go? For here. Okay. Is that credit or debit? Credit. And your name? Bob. For here or to go? For here. Credit or debit? With fast food like this, who needs all day oven home cooking? If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, call in toll-free number 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach me on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. Or you can get me through Facebook, or you can get me through Twitter. And on Facebook, regarding my comments about the Black Panthers, Maureen writes, excellent, as always. Can you see why I like to read Maureen's comments? There's just something about Maureen's comments that I like. Maureen also comments on Obama's lawsuit against Arizona. She says, Obama is a moron who should never have been elected. What were people thinking? Well, I'll tell you exactly what they were thinking, Maureen. They were thinking he was a good speaker, and they were thinking that if they voted against him, somebody would call them a racist. Now, our other Maureen, just as opinionated as Maureen 1, says regarding Pelosi's comment about money for the unemployed, Maureen says, okay, then based on this latest Pelosiism, we should lay off more people and put them on unemployment, and voila, more jobs will be created somehow. And on Israel, Maureen asks, why does the Prime Minister of Israel bother to meet with Obama? Well, Maureen, he does that because he has been brainwashed into thinking that he must cower to the United States. Now, regarding a previous show where I discussed Bible prophecy and talked about how the temple will someday be rebuilt according to Bible prophecy, Michael says the temple is the abomination of desolation. Well, that's actually not true, Michael. The abomination of desolation refers to a time when a man known as the Antichrist will go into the temple and proclaim himself to be God. That is the abomination. The temple is not the abomination. Anyway, he goes on. He says, it is the very reason they stoned Stephen to death. He tried to tell them it was superstition. The church temples and markets are not exempt. There shall not be one stone left upon another. See, this guy also has a problem with church buildings. So I see a little bit of an agenda here. Michael goes on. He says, the scripture says, when you see the abomination, this does not mean it isn't staring you right in the face. It simply means you don't see it yet. People are looking past when Israel sacrifices and then it ceases. This is ridiculous thinking. Sacrifices are the number one qualifier of the abomination. Why else would it have been destroyed twice? Then he quotes to me from Matthew 23:37-39 in the King James Version. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that, I don't know why people quote from the King James Version, all those these and thous and thines and mines put me to sleep. We have better translations. But anyway, he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee. How often, that means sent to you. Wouldn't that have been a better way to say it? And are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings. See, we take all the time to translate this out of the Greek. By the time we read it in King James, we almost need to translate it again. And then he says, behold, your house is left. I'm going to just take the King James out while I read the last. The house is left to you desolate. Oh, I only had one line left. Should have done that from the top. Anyway, Michael continues to say the Gentile church is about to call Jesus the Antichrist. The Gentile church is about to call Jesus the Antichrist. Not sure where he's getting this. I'm going to respond to Michael when we return. Good projects don't just happen. Good projects are a result of a team of dedicated professionals, owners, architects, and contractors striving toward a common goal. Make OMP a part of your team. If you're looking for professional, knowledgeable experience for your construction project team, Oso Miller Pacific should be your first call. For over 20 years, Mark Miller has been providing project management and constructive services throughout San Diego and Southern California. As president of Oso Miller Pacific, Mark continues this tradition of providing the most professional services in the industry to the healthcare, commercial, and government construction markets. Oso Miller Pacific provides a full range of pre-construction services, including definition of needs, design team selection, concept budget generation, and construction services. This full range of services is what sets Oso Miller Pacific apart from its competition. Visit their website at osomillerpacific.com. That's www.osomillerpacific.com or call the offices at 619-449-0633. Again, the number is 619-449-0633. Good projects don't just happen. Call Oso Miller Pacific. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I was reading an email from Michael. Michael was responding to a talk I did a few weeks ago about Daniel's calendar of the 70 weeks, where he gave the prophetic ending of Israel's history. This includes the necessary rebuilding of a third temple. Now, Michael's taking issue with the idea of the temple being rebuilt, and he's making, he's a little vague, but he seems to be making two points, and one of them I seem to be agreeing with, and one of them I don't seem to be agreeing with. One is the point that he seems to be suggesting that under the new covenant, we don't need a temple anymore. I would agree with that. But he's also calling the temple itself an abomination of desolation. That I don't agree with. So let me be clear. Michael, when I was talking about prophecy, I was merely pointing out that the temple will be rebuilt. Whether it should be, whether it shouldn't be, whether we're in the old covenant, whether we're in the new covenant, God knows what people are going to do, whether he approves or not. And he was just predicting what will happen. Now, naturally, animal sacrifice was part of the old covenant, fulfilled by Jesus' ultimate sacrifice for our sins. And the new temple is something the Antichrist will exploit. My point, Michael, is that the Bible is being accurate by predicting the rebuilding of the temple, whatever God may think of the temple. However, Michael, as for the temple being destroyed twice, when you said it was destroyed twice because it was built, that's not true. The temple was destroyed under the old covenant. Under the old covenant, God had commanded them. I'm not sure what Bible you're reading. If you don't understand, God had commanded them to make those animal sacrifices. The Jews were living in disobedience to God and worshiping idols when the temple was destroyed the first time. And of course, it can be argued that they had rejected their Messiah and that the Sadducees and the Pharisees were very corrupt leadership of the people of Israel when the temple was commanded, was gone ahead and destroyed the second time. So the third one, no, we don't need a third temple because Christ has come as the ultimate sacrifice. There will be a third temple, however. And I say that because there's an awful lot of Bible prophecy that hasn't been fulfilled, and there's going to be a temple. when the second temple was destroyed, that just means that the third temple must be rebuilt before those other prophecies can take place. Well, last week, right at the end of the program, I was talking about how the story of Adam and Eve is frequently referred to as a fairy tale. I said I used to view it that way myself until a careful study of this story brought about a very interesting discovery. Genesis chapters 1 through 3 is the most logical explanation I have ever seen to account for our world's condition. On previous Bob Siegel shows, I have described life as a paradise invaded. Genesis offers a reason for this picture. You know what I mean when I say paradise invaded? We live in this beautiful world. There's sunsets and snow-capped mountains, but we also have earthquakes and tidal waves, and human beings do wonderful things, but human beings die of disease, and human beings are filled with love, and human beings are filled with hate. There's a dichotomy in human beings. There's a dichotomy in the world. Well, Genesis offers a reason for this picture. Ignore the Genesis account if you want, but you will only have to search for a similar explanation. The world was once a terrific place, but people did not appreciate their paradise. They wanted to know what evil is. I'm always hearing, where is God when wars and crimes kill people? Where is God when children starve to death? I have a better question. Where are people? Where are people when these things happen? The principles of love, kindness, and sharing originated from God. These are His commands. Suffering in the world does not convince me that God doesn't exist. Instead, it convinces me that God knew what He was talking about when He commanded us to feed the poor and when He said, you shall not kill. Notice I didn't read it from the King James that time. I just said, you shall not kill. I could have said, thou shalt not kill. But I translated it for you because that's just the kind of guy I am. Anyway, the devastating results of evil display crystal clear evidence that we should have obeyed God all along. God was being loving when He established guidelines and limitations. He didn't do that because He needs to boss us around. He knew that was the only way we could get through life. And you think, but Bob, wouldn't these guidelines and limitations violate the very free will God supposedly wants us to have? My friend, limitations do not obliterate our will. They exist as a choice for the person who wants to live righteously. As I've mentioned before, God is primarily concerned with how we treat people. He's not out to stifle our creativity. He's not out to nullify our unique personalities. Yeah, but Bob, why should the limitations be introduced on Judgment Day? Why doesn't God just destroy all evil now? You know, that always sounds good. Why doesn't God destroy all evil now? Well, who would be left? In God's eyes, you too are evil. You want Him to start with you? Should He do a thorough job by wiping you out? Evil has its varying manifestations, but no one person is completely free of evil. If we want God to be merciful with us, we must live with the fact that He will offer His grace to everybody, and that's why Christ came and died for everybody, and that's why Christ claims to be the only way to God. Rest assured, God will deal drastically and adequately with all evil. The person who does not accept Christ will pay the penalty for his or her own sin. There can never be a more final, deadly judgment of evil than total, ultimate separation from the joys of life and the presence of God. When we remember that humans, with their free will, are graciously granted an entire lifetime to either accept or reject Jesus, we can understand that for a designated period of time, evil must be allowed. Since not everybody will accept His grace, and since evil still must be dealt with, we are left with the affirmation of an eternal prison called hell. Well, my purpose these last few weeks, and you can go on my website, bobsiegel.net, and listen to these earlier talks that go back about four weeks now. My purpose in these talks was to explain the relationship between God's justice and mercy. The cross is the demonstration of God's justice and mercy combined. Justice said sin had to be dealt with. Mercy said God didn't want you to deal with it, so Jesus dealt with it on your behalf. Although God delights in creatures of free will, such freedom has certain responsibilities. The violation of these responsibilities results in sin. Sin, of course, means selfishness. Humans are sinners by nature and by choice. Through Jesus and His sacrifice, all selfishness can be done away with. This was the teaching of His gospel, which means good news. The authority of the message comes from the fantastic truth that Jesus was actually God in the form of a man. These claims, incredible as they are, will be considered by anyone with a truly open mind. And once again, I urge you to go and look at our backlog of posted shows on my website to get more detail if you're jumping into this for the first time. Here's another question, but a related question. Bob, if God is willing to speak with anyone, then why are there so many different religions? Do they each present the same truth in a different fashion? If so, Jesus would not be the only way. We are moving now into the question of consistency. That's a very good question. It would help to start with a teaching from the ancient philosopher Aristotle. I'm referring to his law of non-contradiction. This law, fundamental to philosophy, you've heard about it if you've taken any philosophy class, states that two given truth claims must not contradict. If they do, at least one of them is wrong. Possibly they are both wrong. In other words, a husband can't call his wife on the phone and say, "Sweetie, I'm coming home for dinner, and yet I am not coming home for dinner." Sounds simple? It should. We accept this idea without hesitation in every facet of life. Every facet of life except religion, that is. We'll be back in a few minutes.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back. People are usually afraid to test religions out of fear that they will be showing intolerance. It should be noted that one can respect freedom of religion without assuming that all religions are equally valid, because such a conclusion, frankly, is intellectually dishonest. While lecturing at the University of Minnesota, the noted Christian apologist Cliff Konecny, wonderful man, was confronted by a student who claimed that all religions were basically the same. Cliff responded with a piercing analogy. He said, "If I were to assume that all Chinese people were the same, it would mean one of two things. Either I'm a bigot, or I have not taken the time to get to know Chinese people." The same is true of religious assumptions. Isn't that interesting? We don't always catch this. Even when admitting that religions do, in fact, teach opposite theologies, many stubbornly grasp the idea that somehow every one of them came from the same God. Why is it so easy to envision a creator who unveils contradictory information? Why must a belief in God be divorced from our God-given ability to think? Paradoxically, people are not afraid to put Christianity through the ringer. Its claims are confronted all the time. Once, while doing an open forum at Fresno City College, I was asked about Mormonism. I mentioned that Mormonism, and I didn't say it with any disrespect, but I mentioned that Mormonism claimed to go by the Bible, yet taught polytheism, the belief in more than one God, which completely contradicts the Bible. Isaiah 43:10 says, "I alone am God. Before me, no God existed. Neither shall there be any after me." Well, a young lady raised her hand. She says, "What right do you have to stand here and scrutinize somebody else's religion?" I just looked at her. I said, "You know, for the last 2 hours, you and your friends have been doing nothing but scrutinizing my religion. Doesn't the Bible contradict itself? How do we know Jesus rose from the dead? Why would a loving God send people to hell? I said, and this has not bothered me. It has been very appropriate. You should challenge anyone who makes a truth claim. But make no mistake, it works both ways. I will ask these same questions of other religious. She nodded as her double standard became obvious. Her earlier skeptical questions confirmed an honest inward conviction that all beliefs, even religious ones, must be examined. We must test whether they contradict themselves. We must test whether they contradict each other. There isn't the time right now to give every major religion its rightful day in court, but some brief examples will at least illustrate the process. Let's look at Hinduism. Now, there's all kinds of denominations of Hinduism. Some Hindus believe that God and creation are one and the same. The Bible, on the other hand, paints a major distinction between the creation and the creator. If one person says God made the tree, and another person says, no, actually, God is the tree, we cannot possibly conclude that they're both correct, even though they each use a similar word, God. Of course, this leads us to no conclusion at all about the accuracy of Hinduism or Christianity. It is instead a conclusion about the fallacy of universalism. Universalism is the belief that all religions are true. Did you know that when people say all religions are right, they really mean all religions are wrong? Because when you show them how the religions contradict themselves, it doesn't really matter to them. And it doesn't matter because they think all religions are made up, comforting fantasies anyway. But the founders of our religions didn't claim they were made up fantasies. They claimed they were true. They claimed it was a truth that they got from God. On the other hand, Hinduism makes no claims to historical verification. Christianity does, and that's a significant thing to note. There are also contradictions between religions which accept the Bible. A lot of people don't realize that Islam not only goes by the Quran. Islam claims that the Bible is the word of God, too. A lot of people don't realize this. To them, the Quran is not an alternative to the Bible. It's a sequel to the Bible. Islam claims, and I want to be very clear, Islam claims that in addition to the Quran, both the Old and New Testament are the word of God. Jesus is talked about a lot in the Quran as a holy prophet, but not an incarnation of God himself. They don't believe Jesus was God. They believe Jesus was a prophet of God. Well, the test for a prophet in the Old Testament, which Muslims claim to go by, the test in the Old Prophet is that he must be accurate in everything he teaches, or he's not a real prophet. Jesus taught that he was God. Now, if Jesus was lying, he was not a prophet. But Islam claims he was a prophet. If Jesus was telling the truth, then Jesus is who he claimed to be, God. But Islam claims he wasn't God. Either way, we have a rather serious contradiction. And you'll recall a few weeks ago, I spent a lot of time on the Daniel 9 calendar. Well, Judaism teaches that the Old Covenant will be changed after the Messiah comes, according to Jeremiah 31. Daniel 9 actually computes that time by measuring the amount. Remember, we went through this painstakingly. It measured the amount in Hebrew years of 30 days each. He starts with the return of the Jews from Persian exile, when King Artaxerxes freed the Jewish slaves, and he ends with the Messiah's arrival. This day occurred on Nisan 10, according to the Persian calendar, or March 30th, 33 AD, according to our Roman Julian calendar. Only one potential Messiah rode into Jerusalem that day, Jesus of Nazareth. If he was the Messiah, then Judaism's new covenant, called Christianity, is now in force. If he wasn't the Messiah, then Daniel was a false prophet. But Judaism considers Daniel to be a true prophet. We have found a contradiction with Judaism as well. And I'm saying that as a Jew. I'm saying that as a Jew who moved on and accepted Jesus as his Messiah. Well, boy, I must be making myself very unpopular right now. Please understand, I do respect the many Muslims, Hindus, Jews, Mormons, Universalists, and others I've met as honest and dedicated people. This does not keep me from examining their claims, however. Well, Bob, if there's only one God who reveals himself, how then do we account for the differences in people's beliefs? Well, because a loving God would be a gentleman. He would not force himself upon those who don't want him, but would speak only to those who are seeking. Most people accept the religion they were brought up in without question. Others, when choosing a religion, choose the one that they like or the one that is convenient. Sometimes, like sheep, they are mesmerized by talented orators who speak with charisma and authority. We have only to recall the 900 unfortunate individuals who followed Jim Jones into the wilderness to remember that most become religious simply to have their needs and feelings satiated. Seldom do they say, I will examine the evidence to see which, if any, of these religions is actually true. Well, we are down to our last few minutes of the Bob Siegel Show. I'm going to start another very interesting discussion, but obviously it's a discussion that's going to conclude next week. Here's a question that I get constantly. Bob, is Obama a Muslim? See, Obama claims to be a Christian. There's all kinds of scuttlebutt claiming that Obama is a Muslim. Well, let me do the first part, the easy part, right away. We must stop all this talk about whether or not Obama is truly a Muslim. He says he isn't. I have no reason not to take him at his word. There's a lot of things the guy says where I don't take him at his word because he's been caught in a lie. I don't think he's lying about this. If it's ever proven otherwise, okay. But you know what? This is not the hill I want to die for. But the religious discussion is far from over. When Obama says he is a Christian, we must carefully ask exactly what does that mean? After all, Christianity has been around for over 2,000 years. Many different kinds of denominations, movements, and cults have taken on the name Christianity. In some of those organizations, the doctrine does not even remotely resemble the teachings of the Bible. And so when Barack Obama says he is a Christian, I humbly ask, what kind of Christian? This has been a fair question for quite some time, inasmuch as Obama used to attend Trinity United Church of Christ, a congregation that teaches black supremacy, displaying the kind of racism that not only smacks in the face of Jesus, but the kind of racism that would smack into any shred of human decency. Some have tried to defend this church by saying they are being misunderstood or taken out of context, but when their pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, gives an award to the Hitlerite Louis Farrakhan, it doesn't take a genius to realize that their reputation is well-deserved. Now, I know, Obama finally denounced Farrakhan, but it seemed too little too late. He held that option open for a very long time, dancing around it until Hillary, his opponent in the election, forced the issue at a debate. Now, granted, his church's connection with Farrakhan is so obvious, it barely warrants another discussion. So allow me to add a new wrinkle to this conversation. Even without all the racial overtones, there is something else about Trinity United that is not being discussed. You see, Trinity belongs to the World Council of Churches. Do you understand what the World Council of Churches is? They are the liberal branch of Christianity where pastors downplay miracles, downplay the need for salvation through Jesus, and essentially adopt any current left-wing politically correct ideology. They reject the Bible as being God's literal word. They are Christian in name only. In fact, the famous Jesus seminar, which concluded that Jesus did not really rise from the dead, was made up for the most part of clergy from the World Council of Churches. This unusual shift of affections began around the turn of the 20th century when many people who grew up in a Protestant America became fascinated with certain philosophies which had been popular in Europe for years and were now spilling to the shores of the United States. Feeling that they had outgrown such archaic ideas as a sin nature or a miracle, some pastors sought to reinterpret the Bible from a more modern point of view. As the scriptures became demythologized, quote unquote, the remaining task for the Christian was to offer social services and leave out all talk about heaven, hell, or a need to be born again. This reconstructed version of the Christian mission became known informally as the social gospel. Now, reacting to the social gospel was a group that crossed denominational lines known as fundamentalists, taking their name from the Bible, fundamentals meaning sin, nature, miracles, and anything else shined off by liberal theologians. The fundamentalists overreacted by shying away from many programs of social reform, fearing that such actions would water down Christ's message. Their return to an honest interpretation of the Bible was admirable, but they were so careful not to be classified as liberal that they went too far. Interestingly enough, the two positions became much more extreme and polarized after their original leaders passed away. Walter Rauschenbusch, an architect of the social gospel, did believe in a supernatural conversion experience. On the other hand, William Jennings Bryan, the most well-known and outspoken fundamentalist, honestly felt that the gospel should leave its imprint upon society and its corresponding economy. Later in the 1950s, people like Billy Graham, and I'm a great admirer of Billy Graham, he's just about the only televangelist that I can stomach. People like Billy Graham sought a happier medium by creating an offshoot of the fundamentalists known as evangelicals. evangelicals. Evangelicals concede the church's obligation to make society a better place. Evangelicals believe that one can practice social reform without compromising the spiritual elements of the gospel. Today it gets a bit confusing because most people use the words fundamentalist and evangelical interchangeably. Many with a fundamentalist mentality call themselves evangelicals. Likewise, evangelicals claiming to believe in a literal interpretation of God's word are labeled fundamentalists and are accused of being uninterested in the poor and the needy. More of this historical discussion of what split the church between left and right, liberal and conservative. Next week, we'll see you then.